Good evening. Welcome to the 13th Congressional District Debate. Tonight, incumbent Republican Representative Rodney Davis faces his Democratic challenger, Mark Wicklund. This district is one of the largest in central Illinois. It stretches from Champaign-Urbana west to the Mississippi River and down to the suburbs of St. Louis. I'm Nyla Boodoo, your moderator for this evening. I host a statewide radio program, The 21st, based right here at WILL. On behalf of Illinois Public Media, I'd like to thank our other partners who helped make tonight's debate possible. NPR Illinois in Springfield, the NAACP of Champaign County, and the League of Women Voters of Champaign County. The League of Women Voters are also our timekeepers this evening. And on a related note, I'm pleased to present to you our entirely female panel of journalists this evening. Amanda Vinicky is the State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Jamie Dunn is the Illinois Issues Editor for NPR Illinois. And Jordan Abadea is the political reporter for WICS News Channel 20 in Springfield. Here's how this evening will go. Our panelists will ask a question, and both candidates will have 2 minutes each to answer. We'll allow for a one-minute rebuttal if necessary. We won't be taking questions from our audience this evening. There also won't be any opening or closing statements, and we're going to jump right into things in just a minute. But first, I'd like to thank our in-studio audience of Illinois voters who are with us this evening. Our audience has agreed to refrain from applause or audible reactions during the debate, except for right now when we welcome our candidates. Gentlemen, thank you for being here this evening. We flipped a coin, and Representative Davis, you'll get the first question. Amanda Vinicky has our first question this evening about the national presidential candidates.
All right. Good evening, gentlemen. Thanks so much. For starters, Representative Davis, your party's nominee said a judge couldn't fairly adjudicate a case because his parents were Mexican. He said that Muslims should be barred from the country. You not only supported Donald Trump, you agreed to be on his Agriculture Advisory Committee. Why were Mr. Trump's comments about women in 2005 your breaking point? And then for you, Mr. Wicklund, we've heard so much about Secretary Clinton's emails. Even the FBI has characterized it as poor judgment on her behalf. This past weekend, we saw in some emails that the secretary had said she had different private and public stances. How can voters trust what she says? She says one thing at a private event and another on the campaign trail. Mr. Davis, you first.
Well, Amanda, thank you for your question. Thank you for being here again. It's a privilege to be back in the studio to talk about issues that are important to this country. And frankly, as a member of Congress, this is the first presidential race I've ever experienced. I don't know if I'll look forward to the next one. It's been very interesting and very frustrating, I think, to many Americans, the tone of the presidential race. And many of the issues you brought up, I completely disagree with those statements. And as you know, I made a decision as a parent just last weekend to remove my endorsement of the Republican nominee and also asked to be removed from the Agricultural Advisory Committee that I was named to that never met. It's a decision that my wife and I made across the kitchen counter when we heard the recent comments. We're the parents of three teenagers. My daughter's in college. My twin boys are sophomores in high school. What we heard was something that I don't think should be heard from anyone, let alone candidates running for the President of the United States. We made that decision, and we released that decision this past weekend. I'm not going to stand here and defend any of the presidential candidates, and frankly, I think Hillary Clinton is unfit to be in office. I think she disqualified herself for me on September 11th of 2012. When, as the Secretary of State in this administration, she, as testimony has shown, allowed would-be rescuers to change clothes out of political correctness instead of putting planes and soldiers in the air to rescue our Americans in Benghazi, Libya. Amanda, I don't care if you're a Democrat like her or a Republican. You are not fit to be the Commander-in-Chief if you make decisions like that. And that, in my opinion, disqualifies her from being in office. This election is going to be an interesting election. The next few days that are left, I hesitate to wonder what we'll see. But I'm looking forward to discussing the issues tonight about our race rather than about a race that we can't control.
Mr. Wicklund?
I give Rodney credit for stepping up finally and withdrawn his support from Donald Trump. Personally, and a lot of the public wish that would have been sooner. I think some of the comments beforehand were a little brazen on the attack on the judge and others. You know, as in relation to the comments that he said that day, they come out on the media there. I don't think anybody was surprised with what came out of there. That's the Donald Trump we all know. You know, so I give him credit for finally standing up and doing that. Now, on Hillary Clinton, you know, experience-wise, she is the most experienced candidate we have out there. She wasn't my first choice for president. Bernie Sanders was. And I stood by Bernie until the primary was over. And then I've gotten behind my Democratic candidate because I feel she is the leader that will lead us in the direction we need to go without all the media drama that follows it, which we're going to get with Donald Trump.
And what about the public and private personas and all of the emails that have been released, though? Do you have any issue with that?
Well, you know, that's basic ethics 101 when you're running for public office, whether it's county board level or not. She should have known to separate her email accounts and to keep them that way. You know, as far as the issues, the FBI has looked at those and felt that there was no need to file any charges with that. I'll take them at their word on that. And, you know, she's promised to do better going down the road, and I'll hold her to that promise.
Representative Davis, would you like to respond?
Well, Mark and I are here to discuss the issues in our race, and it's nice to be able to stand here in a debate and be able to talk about the issues that we can control. Now, as Mark said, we didn't support either of the two candidates in the primary. As many of you know and the viewers do, that I supported Marco Rubio. I still think he'd make a great president. Hillary Clinton is one of the most corrupt candidates that I think we've ever experienced in this nation. And the fact of the matter is we have the two most unpopular candidates for president that I hope we'll ever see in our lifetime. And I hope that as we move forward, that America begins to look at the presidency and the race that we see today and ensure that it never happens again.
Jamie Dunn has our second question. Mr. Wicklund, you'll be the first to answer.
For a while, it looked like there was going to be another man joining you two on the stage, Dr. David Gill, who ran as an independent, but he dropped out. Following a successful challenge to his petitions and an ongoing court case that could take years to complete. Does Illinois make it too difficult for independent and unestablished party candidates to run for Congress? And if so, what do you think is a satisfactory bar for signatures to get onto the ballot?
Well, knowing David Gill for as long as I have, you know, I gave him credit for as far as he got and taking on the constitutional values of this issue. But David Gill's also had problems with petitions in the past. I personally have been part of organizations that have gone out and got 100,000 signatures in 30 days. To say that it's impossible to get 11,000 signatures, that's not right. It's a clear method on how you get there, and the process he went about collecting those signatures was the wrong problem. That was his biggest problem, was how they went about doing those. You know, if we open this up to anybody getting on the ballot as an independent, we're going to have a field so big that it's going to look like the Republican primary race, where you're going to have tons of candidates standing up here debating each other. If they want to move the independents into the primary where they can battle each other out in the primary and one winner comes out of that, then I say we reduce the number of signatures required and we run that route. But the way it's set up right now, it's designed to reduce the number of independents that we have in this race, and I stand with that, but we do need some changes.
This is an issue that neither Mark and I can solve in Washington. This is an issue that's set at the state of Illinois. Ironically, David Gill, a candidate I stood next to in this studio 4 years ago, he ran as a Democrat, not just that time, but three other times. He chose to run as an independent this time, and then actually filed a lawsuit where fellow Democrats that had supported him in the past were the ones defending the requirements set by the state of Illinois. If the signature requirements need to be changed, in his mind, he needs to go speak with Speaker Madigan, President Cullerton, Governor Rauner, and lobby the state legislators who actually can impact this decision, because neither of us can.
But do you have any thoughts on it, Congressman Davis?
Oh, there's always instances where signature petition requirements come into question. You know, there are those that say we should have a higher threshold for running for Congress. Ours isn't even as high as running for state Senate. These are the types of debates that I think our state legislators need to have. And maybe this instance this year will allow them to do that.
Mr. Wicklund, would you like an opportunity to respond?
Well, I'm hoping the state picks this up because it is a serious issue. And I'm glad that David Gill dropped his complaint on this. You know, the issue line, we get through this election cycle, court comes down, we could turn around and taxpayers could be looking at spending a couple million dollars just to rehold an election. You know, Rodney's right on that. We know the standards. Personally, when we were out there circulating petitions, we collected close to 3,000 signatures. But in the process of doing that, we used resources available to make sure that the petitions we handed in were clear and there was going to be no issues on this. And that's what we filed. That's why we only filed close to 1,500 signatures. It was in the bag. I pulled Rodney's petitions just like they pulled mine. We wanted to take a look and see what was in there. And with David Gill's, it was blatant what was in those petitions.
One issue Congress does have a say on is trade. Jordan Abadea has the next question about that. Representative Davis, you'll start.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Both candidates for president have come out against some of the recent trade deals. Some have called them anti-trade. Where do you both stand on free trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership? And do you think that they play an important role in the American economy, specifically around agriculture?
Trade is important. Free trade is important. But it also has to be fair. And as we look at Central Illinois, this district is surrounded by some of the best farmland, most expensive farmland in America, and most fertile. I think our farmers feed the world, and they don't get enough credit for that. And we have some of the agribusiness giants in this district, too, that create some of the best-paying jobs we have. And looking at commodity prices this year, with them being so low, the only way to continue to dominate in our agricultural sector right here in the Midwest is to make sure we expand our marketplaces. And it's also for manufacturing. When you look at manufacturing, go to Caterpillar Indicator. They make mining trucks. This administration has tried to kill the coal mining industry, has not allowed Caterpillar to sell mining trucks in this country like they used to. So what markets do we need to open so that the UAW workers in Decatur, Illinois can still have those jobs? Well, it's places like the Pacific Rim. Now, I'll be honest with you, Jordan. I don't see the TPP having a chance of passing at all. And it's not because we can't negotiate a final fair agreement and a free agreement. It's because this president hasn't done enough to get his own party to support it and break through the rhetoric on trade that the presidential race has given us.
You know, I don't know that I can blame this on the president. Here's the problem with the TPP, and we'll start with that, is the size of that bill. It's ridiculous. The trade agreements, they need to be agreements that are solely on agriculture, mining equipment, or whatever, and we can get that done. It just takes a little bit of time, and we have to separate those big ominous bills that we see out there. That lies the huge problem, is we've got these big, huge bills that, you know, Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid and others said we just haven't read through these bills. Well, that's our first job, is to read through these bills and know what's in them, and we've seen the outcome from bills like this with NAFTA. I've seen that personally on the manufacturing indicator when I worked at Mueller's, when that come through, and seeing the decline in jobs and part of our factory moving down south of the border down there. So, you know, firsthand, I've seen what these have done, and it's just the mass size of these bills. It's, you know, we no longer have a clean bill that we can pass through the House and the Senate to get to the president. They've become big, ominous bills.
Well, Mark's right. Some of the previous trade agreements have not been fair to the United States, and that's why I tried to change things. When we passed Trade Promotion Authority, which really sets the framework for any trade agreement, not just the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but also TTIP, which will actually create bilateral agreements for us with the European Union and countries that we are allies with. I helped change the enforcement provisions to solve a problem that's been a problem for two decades. It's countries like China and South Korea and India dumping steel into this country. And what they did, Mark knows as a former steel worker, that when that cheap steel comes in, it actually hurts American steel. And in the processes before I helped change them, all the steel would be gone into the marketplace before it would be adjudicated and their hands would be slapped. I changed that. And now the Department of Commerce is adjudicating these cases to help American steel workers right here in Central Illinois.
Amanda, our next question, Mr. Wicklund.
Mr. Wicklund, Americans owe more than $1 trillion in student loan debt. One in four students, loan borrowers are late on their payments or have defaulted. So what should be done to help graduates who can't pay off the debt that they have or that are too burdened to do things like buy their first home?
Well, having children that were in college and knowing what the cost is, it's gotten out of hand. And you know, the first thing that the government should do is go in and fix the interest rates that are on these student loans. They're too high. The interest rate on that loan should be no more than enough to cover the fees associated with running that program. That would be a starting point. The second would be to look at some of these huge, huge salaries that are being paid out to administrative and that, and not only being paid out at that time, but if they're fired or terminated, the settlements that are agreed to with these university leaders is astronomical. You know, and outside of that, you look at the Wells Fargo settlement today with their CEO. These are the same type of settlement agreements that are made, whether it's school administration or the head of a CEO. When they're being canned because of poor performance, they take their fair share before they leave, and we need to address that issue there. We also need to look at moving some of the programs that we've moved out of public schools, out of the high school format, and that into community college settings, which increase the fees on individuals who were not looking to go to college, will not survive in college as a student. These were programs that were set up for skilled trade jobs in the high school so that they got this training while they were going through high school along with their math and science and history, and then into the technical academy that was affiliated with Decatur Public School District that's now part of the community college out there. By moving those back into a public school setting, reducing those costs and the time that a student's going to have to spend in college will help reduce some of that cost.
Thank you.
Well, Amanda, this is the next bubble that I think could burst, and we have to continue to address the student debt crisis. Mark's right. We needed to lower the interest rates, and I did that. I helped pass a bill that actually took government out of the business of setting student loan rates, where students just a few years ago were having to pay 6.6%. Now those students and families can take advantage of interest rates that are in the threes, like everyone should be able to in this day and age of historic low interest rates. And you know, it means something to me because I've got a daughter in college. She's a sophomore at Illinois State University, and I, like many families, sit around the kitchen counter and wonder, you know, what's the cost going to be able to get my daughter that education. And I'm a member of Congress. I get paid well. I can afford it. But you know what? There are many families struggling to find that way to get that education, that higher education degree for their kids. And we've got to have other options. We've got to make sure that the 529 programs, and I've been working with Treasurer Mike Frericks to make our 529 programs better. Things like, you know, we've passed bills to allow purchases of computers. When I was in college, that didn't matter. But you can't take a college class today without a laptop. And you ought to be able to use the hard-earned money that families have saved tax-free in the 529 plans to be able to buy a computer so that those students can succeed at college in every single class that they take. But Amanda, I'm also proud of a bill that I've introduced called the Employer Participation in Student Assistance Act. And what that does, it creates a program that will allow companies to pay back student loans for the employee on a tax-free basis, similar to a tuition reimbursement program. I testified on my bill that in just doing some simple math, $30,000 a year or $30,000 in debt is what the average student is in right now when they graduate. 159,000 students in 2012 defaulted on their loans. That's $4.5 billion where the taxpayers have actually have that on their backs. We can change that by having a tool. And I testified in front of the Ways and Means Committee, had one of the most liberal members of Congress, Keith Ellison, one of the most conservative members, Dave Bratt, both come to me, ironically, on my left and right, and want to co-sponsor that bill.
Mr. Wicklund, would you like to follow up?
Yeah, it is. But here we are dumping college education on the feet of employees. And employers are having enough problems now being able to afford salaries, health care, and issues like that. Now, if this is a generated program that an employer is requiring, I feel they should help pick up some of the cost of that and should bear some of that burden. But if we're just talking about employers picking up the burden for students in college, I think we're headed the wrong direction with that.
Jamie, next question for Representative Davis.
The urgency of the Black Lives Matter movement continues to grow with each fatal police shooting of Black Americans. Have you met with Black Lives Matter activists about this issue? And if not, what would you say to them?
Let me address what Mark said about the bill. The bill actually would incentivize employers with a tax credit to be able to offer this to their employees and use it as part of their benefits plan to recruit the best and the brightest who are worried. Students are worried about repaying their student loans. Students, new recent grads and new employees can't save in their 401ks. They can't save for a home, a vehicle, and do the things that families used to do just 20, 30 years ago because of student debt.
Okay,
this is another tool
in the toolbox. I appreciate that you want to get a rebuttal in a little on that, but I'm going to ask you to redirect to the question.
Sure. I've met with numerous leaders of all communities in my district, and I think it's a tragedy that there is a tremendous lack of communication in many communities that leads to the tragedies that we've seen. We want to do everything we can to stop that. And as a matter of fact, I travel around and speak to students in high schools, grade schools, colleges, and this is an issue they bring up to me. I was at Urbana High School just last year when this was brought up. And my goal is, how do I fix it? Other than supporting communities like Champaign to institute body cameras, I want to make sure there's open communication between our students and local leaders. Every student, and I urge them to get to know their police chief, and also get to know the local officials who have jurisdiction over the police department. Because when there's more communication, and you and I both know each other, we're going to be able to avoid many of the problems that I think we've seen.
Well, I've grown up in the inner city of Decatur, so I know firsthand what their struggles are. And being involved with the African-American community as long as I have over there in Decatur, you know, the issue is we need serious judicial reform. We see what's playing out in the courts, and this angers a lot of people, whether it's Black Lives Matter or other individuals. We need some serious judicial reform. We have African Americans go to prison at a higher rate than what their white counterparts are or other ethnicity groups. Donald Trump has emphasized throwing search and seizure back in. That does not benefit anybody. We've seen the harm of that. So how do we get to that? Well, we need law enforcement to be back on the street like they were when I was a child growing up in the inner city of Decatur, where you've seen them. You knew who they were. They were there every day. They lived in their communities. They drove cars that people could recognize instead of blacked out vehicles that might get, recognized as a drug dealer or something come down there instead of an actual law enforcement vehicle. And that's some of the problems I've seen in Decatur and other communities. Law enforcement needs to have a stronger presence with inside their community, on the street, in their schools, in their churches, where they can relate to what's going on. Right now we have law enforcement in Decatur that lives 40, 50 miles outside of the town. How do you represent your community and serve and protect them if you don't know firsthand what's going on within that community? And that's just some of the judicial reform and some of the local reforms that need to be done within the African American community in inner cities. And we need to keep that up and keep that fight going to start changing that direction, because the outcome by not doing anything has allowed other elements to infringe within the Black Lives Matters community, and they've taken it upon their personal belief to go after law enforcement. That's wrong, no matter what group you stand with, to turn your anger towards some other individual instead of standing there and fighting for what you believe in. And we need to rein that in. We have too many law enforcement officers losing lives also.
And I just want to be really clear on a just yes, no from both of you. Have you sat down with activists from Black Lives Matter and heard their concerns and priorities? Mr.
Yes.
No.
Representative, do you plan to?
Sure.
And I have a follow-up for both of you as well. Does Congress, do you think, have a role in increasing the accountability of law enforcement or others in the criminal justice system to have mandatory training, bias training, other programs for law enforcement in that way? Representative?
Well, I think law enforcement needs as much opportunity for training as they can get at all levels. Now, Mark and I, we agree that attacking law enforcement officers is not something that should be put forth. We also agree on criminal justice reform. And as a matter of fact, I think it's tragic that we see petty drug offenders spending more time in prison because they don't give the prosecutors information they think they should give than Jared the Subway guy who's a pedophile. That's wrong, and we've got to change that. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Nolly, could you repeat
your question? Sure. The question is if you think Congress has a role in increasing the accountability of law enforcement in terms of bias training, other sorts of training for police officers.
You know, I think as a representative in the U.S. House, I think we have an obligation and a duty to the public to make sure law enforcement is taking their job serious, getting the training that they need, and the dollars they need to fund these issues. I think Congress has the responsibility to stand up there as a leader and kind of project where they like for their communities and their districts to go and stand there and be with them hand in hand to address whatever issue comes up.
Jordan, you have our next question for Mr. Wicklund.
Mr. Wicklund, a majority of Americans support comprehensive background checks, closing the gun show loophole. Do you support any additional kind of gun control or gun control reform? And what policies would you support? Why or why not?
Thank you. That's a good question. I get hit with that all the time, being a Democrat. I do stand behind the Second Amendment. These loopholes in these big gun shows, and I see them on a first-hand basis. All you gotta do is go over to Indianapolis. They have a huge gun show over there. And they need to monitor and do some background check on who they're selling weapons to. That would reduce a lot of the crime. The other issue we have that nobody's talking about until late in the year, but I've been talking about it for over 16 months, is the huge mental health crisis we have in this country and the lack of it that we've had since the Reagan-Bush administration followed into the Clinton administration with his incarcerating of everybody. It's been a double-headed sword, Democrat and Republicans creating this issue. But we need to take mental health serious. You see, most of the gun violence we've seen have been by mental health. People that have serious issues that aren't getting the help that they need, whether it's from their parents or a counselor that's standing there with them and making sure they're getting the health care they need. Now, that's not pharmaceutical help. Some of the best researchers in the world say that's the worst way to go with mental health is pharmaceuticals, because that leads them down another path of opiate and heroin epidemics, which we have in this country right now, which drugs also increase gun violence within this country. We see what's playing out in Chicago. It's a whole different platform than what we're used to seeing, unless you're from Chicago or the Midwest, and we know how Chicago goes. But there's not one legal gun up there being used in the violence of Chicago. They have some of the strictest gun laws in the country, but they have the highest murder rate going right now, although it's not at record highs, it's getting pretty close. But we need to start focusing on the mental health issue and taking care of some of our students that are in school that our administrators and them know have mental health problems, whether it's family related or the student and their learning ability. They are our first responders, as you say, in the classroom, seeing what's going on with the students and the public and that. And I think that's where we need to head.
Mental health is a major issue, especially in dealing with tragic crimes that we've seen happen throughout this country. If you look at the non-terrorist mass killings that have plagued our country, all of them are due to mental illness. Well, we've tried to pass a bill that I co-sponsored, sponsored by the only clinical psychologist that we have in Congress, Dr. Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania. This bill would do some of the things that Mark talked about and do many of the things to address mental health issues before they get to stage four, that crisis stage. That bill passed the House in a very bipartisan way. It's being held up in the U.S. Senate right now. I would urge all your viewers and all the viewers tonight, call your U.S. senator, tell them immediately when we return to Washington, pass that bill to the president's desk. It is too crucial. Now, I've supported increases in funding to the National Instant Criminal Background Checks. I think we need to do that. But I agree with my opponent on the issue that when you see gun violence in communities, criminals don't care about a FOID card. They don't care whether they check the right box on an application. So every time a new law is passed to address a problem that criminals will never follow anyway, it only affects law-abiding citizens. That's something I'm going to fight against. We need to address the root cause and root problem of criminal behavior, and that starts with the mental health.
I have a quick follow-up for both of you. You mentioned Chicago, and when gun control comes up, that's always mentioned. A study was done recently that said a majority of the crimes committed in Chicago were committed with guns that came from outside of the city. So is there something at the federal level that we can do to prevent guns from coming into our state from other states that have weaker laws than we do? Or are laws not as efficient or effective when you have a neighboring state that has less laws than you do? Mr. Wicklund?
We get a balance with both on that. You're right. But this is part of closing the gun show loophole that's out there, because they can go next door to Indiana, go in there and purchase a weapon of any caliber they want and bring it back into Chicago. You know, in Indiana, a lot of guns come out of that state over there. But we need to close that loophole. That right there will tighten that up and reduce the amount of guns going into the Chicago area.
Mr. Davis?
Jordan, we need to remember that no matter what law we pass, criminals don't worry about following that law, and it will only affect law-abiding citizens. And that's what we have to focus on.
Thank you.
Amanda, next question for Representative Davis.
All right. At a time when many Americans say they don't like either presidential candidate, or in fact, I think, Congressman, as you phrased it, the most unpopular candidates we've seen in our lifetime, where little priority in Washington has been given to even passing budgets, and where approval ratings of Congress are a whopping 11%, according to Gallup, make an argument for us in defense of government. You, Congressman Davis, have been involved in Washington politics since, what, 1998, and you're seeking to go there. So defend government, please.
Well, there are some things that are indefensible. You know, part of the gridlock that we see in Washington, I think, is indefensible, and that's what I've been trying to do over my first 4 years in Washington. I've tried to change things. I've tried to make reforms. And those are the types of efforts that I stood here 4 years ago and promised that I would make as a member of Congress. We have to talk about the successes of this Congress. We've had many pieces of legislation, over 600 bills passed the House that addressed problems like the opioid crisis, mental health reform, education. We reformed No Child Left Behind, a bill that no one in the educational system, the K-12 system, no one supported by the time we fixed it. It's going to give more local control to our schools, our parents, our teachers, our principals, our school boards. Those are the types of decisions that we were able to make in a bipartisan way. It's unfortunate sometimes those successes in the highway bill, bringing infrastructure dollars, your gas tax dollars back to Illinois to rebuild our crumbling roads and bridges. It's a shame that those positive developments don't get enough attention. And I think that adds to part of the problem that we have with a polarized environment in Washington, D.C. But I'm going to continue to go back to Washington and do things like passing the reform to Obamacare, my Hire More Heroes Act, that will incentivize small businesses to hire our veterans. Those are the types of positive successes that I've been able to work on, and I'm going to continue to do that as a representative in the 115th Congress.
Well, I think we'll start with the veterans job bill. On stance, it's a good bill that everybody can get behind. Here's the issue with that. We keep passing these veterans jobs bills. Where are the jobs that go along with these bills? And there lacks a problem with continuing to pass this style of bill. If we're going to do that, and I'm all in favor of passing veterans jobs bills, but we need to start creating better paying jobs, and so that the jobs are there for our veterans and other community members. And that's one thing we haven't done. Although unemployment's down, the job rate's up, what we've created is a heavy burden on service industry jobs. And we all know that unless we have a strong workforce and a strong economic drive behind that with manufacturing, agriculture, and stuff like that, these service jobs are going to continue to fold up. We see them roll out in Decatur. They're open a few months, then they're down because they don't have the base to continue to supply the support that they need. You know, so what's worked in Washington? You know, our president has worked, you know, with the Republican-controlled Senate and House. He's still managed to get a lot accomplished that he doesn't get a lot of credit for, with unemployment being down, 150,000 jobs, you know, although I think those jobs could be better-paying jobs. Then we wouldn't have the issue of minimum wage on there. We'd have better-paying jobs right off the bat. You know, those are some of the things. But what we're lacking in Washington is pure leadership on either party side and in either the House or the Senate. We don't see the leadership that we've had in Washington in the past. And that's sad to say, but we need people back in there to do that. you know, on the county board over there in Macon County, we worked hard to bring that budget in, have a surplus in that. And this is what Washington should be doing. They should be cleaning up what's going on out there to rein in their spending and rein in their budgets so that we're not wasting the taxpayers' dollars. Those are some of the positive things we could be doing in Washington, D.C. We just need good, strong leaders in there to get the job done.
Congressman Davis, you talked about some parts are indefensible. So to you, what is indefensible and what's the cure for it? Well, you're there in Washington. What do you do?
Yeah, Amanda, what's indefensible is you have a president of the United States that, and I got to disagree with Mark, that he could have had many more successes. But we have a stagnant economy, we have stagnant job growth, and this president hasn't introduced a balanced budget his entire two terms for 8 years. I have personally supported balanced budgets every single year that I've been given a chance to vote on a budget. These are the types of things that lead to more polarization. The president is responsible for much of the polarization in the American electorate right now. He has not wanted to work with us to address major issues in this country. And Mark, I appreciate your comments on my Hire More Heroes bill. However, small businesses are where we are growing jobs in this country. And small businesses are being penalized by the laws and regulations and rules set in Obamacare that punish them for growing above 50 employees. My bill would allow them to not count veterans toward that 50-employee limit if they were on TRICARE or DOD program. These are the types of solutions and reforms to the terrible, unaffordable CARE Act that we need to help our small businesses grow beyond and create those good-paying jobs that we want to see. But I also want to remind everybody, government doesn't create private sector jobs. Government puts forth the programs and rules and regulations to either help private sector jobs be created or hurt them. And that's exactly, if you go to our Better Way agenda, go to betterway.gop, we have laid out a vision for growing our economy that's going to reduce our regulatory environment. It's going to allow a better tax structure and where we close many of the loopholes that are indefensible and have been put in place long before I even got to Washington. These are the types of ideas that we need to put into action, and this president has failed miserably in making that happen.
You went a little longer, so you can have a minute just for transparency. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Nyla. You know, he's right, and I looked at the Better Way plan that he has online. To me, the first three paragraphs, all I got was a better way to circle back around. There's so much confusion in there without any solid policy on there on how we're going to move this board. And it is a good piece, and you're right on some of it with the education part. But I don't think we agree on that education part. Head Start is a vital resource in our communities and inner cities, and just the regulations put on them and what's going on with the changes, but without the help from Washington to advance their causes to get them up. You know, we were the first ones into the five-year program. I guess that's a curse for being one of the oldest and one of the best Head Start programs in the country. But we've worked through that with the help of the universities in here to figure out if this program's going to work or not. And we've already figured out one of the glitches in there. And, you know, it's tightening of those languages in the Head Start programs and others that we need to move on.
Let's move to health care, Jamie.
The Affordable Care Act appears to be struggling with insurance providers pulling out of marketplaces or increasing premiums and copays. What do you propose to make the ACA affordable? And if the answer is repealing it, what would you replace it with that would ensure people wouldn't lose the coverage that they have now?
Mr. Wicklund?
I'm not in favor of repealing the Affordable Care Act. It's a good starting piece of legislation. We've seen over $100 million wasted, taxpayers' dollars wasted, to dismantle the Affordable Care Act instead of working together in the House and the Senate to fix what's going wrong in there. And before we started losing the insurers in those, physicians were already leaving certain programs, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, which handles our veterans. A lot of people think that's government. It's not. It's managed by United Healthcare. But physicians were leaving those programs as this was rolling out because of the damage they seen that was going to happen to their physician's office and stuff like that. So we need to move, and we need to move. To be the last country to go to a single payer or a Medicare for all, it is unfounded. We should be a leader in so many areas of government in our country, and we fail to do that. We always tend to come last. We can make that adjustment by reining in the health insurance programs we have now that are skyrocketed and heavy middle managed. There's our problem right there, is the middle managed part of that. They take in all the money, or the majority of the money, going into these programs to administer them, instead of the insurance companies administering those programs. I'd like to see a program that removes that middleman, leaving our insurance companies, which have been around, they know the business and how to negotiate, and allow them to manage a health care program that our country so direly needs, that makes it equal health care for everybody in this country, and not just those with the most amount of money or the Cadillac insurance plans. And we see a lot of that in this country.
So would you be looking to streamline the existing system or move to a single payer program?
Well, I think they both work in conjunction. If you streamline what's in there, you're basically moving to a single payer. We have the Medicare system set up there right now. It's how we get to that process, and that starts in Washington with the House and them. Instead of trying to tear things apart, take them what does work in those, throw them out, and add what will work in them.
And what do you think does work?
Right now, there's not much in there. It's the nonprofit I oversee, we've seen a 19% increase. We fall into that funny 50-employee thing, along with some of my friends who own independent businesses, that part of the year, we're at 30-some. The rest of the year, we're at over 70 because of our Head Start program. So that automatically threw us into this second tier that came in later on. And, we need to look at reducing that, and that will benefit small businesses and our nonprofits.
Representative Davis.
Well, Mark described many of the problems that we are facing under the current law. I believe I stood here on this debate floor and warned about some of the problems that Mark talked about doctors leaving the healthcare profession before Obamacare was fully implemented when I first ran in 2012. Unfortunately, virtually every promise that was made by the administration to sell this plan has been broken. I ask anybody who's viewing this to call into my office and let me know if your family is saving an average of $2,500 a year in premiums, because I haven't had anybody come up to me yet and say they are. Now, there's one group in this country that has to get their insurance through the Affordable Care Act. That's members of Congress. My deductibles have gone up, my premiums have gone up, and also a number that means something to my family. It may not mean much to others. The out-of-pocket max went up exponentially. Well, that means something to me because my family hit it one time when my wife, 17 years ago, was fighting cancer as a 26-year-old new mother. So I know what it means to hit that. And there are many families that are going to be facing that exact same situation my family faced, that they're not going to be able to afford to use the coverage they have. And as a matter of fact, we have right now in this country 31 million Americans. That's 10%. Of the 300 million people we have in this country that are still uninsured or unable to afford to use the plans that have been put in place. And I agree with Governor Mark Dayton, who just recently said, he's a Democrat out of Minnesota, he said it's failing. It's failing. Other political leaders have said it's crazy. We have to fix it. We put a bill on the president's desk, passed the House, passed the Senate, to repeal Obamacare. But he used his constitutional right to veto that. And we didn't have enough Democrats with courage in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate to override that veto and save American families the tragedy that is costing them more and making their coverage unaffordable.
But if you repeal, what do you do then? How do you keep the coverage that folks have? How do you keep pre-existing conditions covered?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to defend the healthcare system that was in place before this bill was passed, because it had its failures too. Pre-existing conditions. We have to be able to come up with a plan that's going to work to cover pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps, and making sure those young graduates who can't find a job can remain on their parents' plan so that they can go out and seek that career that they trained for. These are the types of issues that we have to address. And again, go to the Better Way agenda. We've got a plan laid out that's going to use market forces, going to be able to allow insurance to be sold across state lines, to broaden the pool and actually reduce costs and keep the promises that were made when the Affordable Care Act was passed by Democrats, when Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House, when Harry Reid was the President of the Senate, and during Barack Obama's first term. These are the types of decisions that we have to take into consideration when we go into the ballot box and make sure that whomever is president, does not have Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House.
I think we've both had time for follow-ups on that. If you're okay with that, we can move on. Jordan?
All right. There has been talk of reworking this country's immigration laws for more than a decade. What do each of you support in terms of comprehensive immigration reform, and what are you willing to personally commit to today in terms of reworking that system? We will start with Mr. Wicklund.
You're right. The immigration policies we have in this country right now are fouled. And, you know, I'll talk about a young man here from Champaign, Izot. He's a medical student at the U of I. He had to go back home to renew his visa, told it would only take him about 3 weeks. We're almost 3 months this young man's been away from his wife and his family, and he's lost over there. He doesn't know what's going to happen, how we can move this along. You know, forcing immigrants to go back to their home country to renew a visa, this should be done here in the United States, especially when it's a young man. It's been here for 4 years. He has an outstanding community record. His grades are outstanding. His wife's here and child. It's sending them back home to do that. And we need serious immigration reform. And we need to address the visa programs and tighten those up. Most of our terrorists that have attacked this country have been here on the visa program, whether it's a marriage visa or, you know, a work visitor's visa. We need to look at those better, and they need to tighten those visas up a little bit, especially from certain countries. And I'm not specifying certain religions, just certain countries, because everybody wants to clear the name of, you know, Islam and that. And a lot of these people are just hop on the bandwagons. Now, what happened on September 11th wasn't. That was a serious attack on our country and a pure sign of where we needed to address our visa programs. And here we are in 2016. We have not moved past that to rein in that visa program that allowed some of those to come into this country and deal with that. You know, we hear a lot of talk from Donald about building his wall on the southern border. You know, he's so out of date with time on veterans issue and immigration issues that he doesn't realize we have more people going south across the border now than we have coming north across the border. The wall sounds good, and it fuels the fire that he's looking to fuel. It's not the right fire. What we need to be talking about is how we assimilate these people into our society legally.
Well, we do need to talk about reform, and that's the problem. The far right and the far left on this issue have decided to make this a political issue. I'll give you an example. One of my colleagues, who is a Republican in California that represents a 70% Hispanic district, has been doing everything he can to try and get both sides to sit down and discuss securing our borders and making sure we fix some of the problems in our visa programs and ensuring that we have the ability to have a legal path for those who are working that process to be able to accomplish the goal of becoming an American citizen. That's exactly what this process that we currently have in place, but it's so convoluted. And we can't fix that convoluted process that many families come to my office to get assistance with. And one of the most patriotic programs that I've ever gotten to witness are the naturalization ceremonies. People willing to come here and be Americans. Those processes will not be solved by my colleague because of the politicization of the immigration debate. He is pushing solutions and at the same time is being protested by those who want the same solutions. I will give you a personal example. During my first term, I was met by a group to discuss immigration reform at a public meeting in Hillsboro, Illinois. And at the exact same time that I left to move to another public event that they knew about, four members of that same group came to my house, knocked on my door, and my then 12-year-old son opened it to deliver the exact same message that was delivered to me. Bullying tactics like that are not conducive to solving the problems that we need to solve in this country, including this one.
We must run in different packs because I've had that conversation down in Hillsboro also with labor and community members. They did not follow me when I left there, thank goodness. But, you know, it's a serious issue. And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, the failed leadership we have in Washington, D.C., whether it's on the Republican side or the Democratic side. We need our party leaders to stand up and take a stand on this and get their party in line and work with Republicans to get comprehensive immigration reform passed. And it didn't used to be that difficult, but we've made it so partisan, that it plays more into Washington, D.C. now than actual policy does. And our leaders need to remember, when they get to Washington, D.C., it's about policy and about being a leader and pushing through the agenda, what our country needs to keep moving forward. And we're lacking that seriously in Washington right now.
Would either of you, yes or no answer, support a path to legalization for the millions of immigrants that have come here illegally, overstayed their visas, crossed borders, path to citizenship? Yes or no, Mr. Wicklund?
If you're looking for just a yes or no answer, I'll give you my simple answer, yes.
Well, I've learned as a member of Congress that to be able to negotiate this piecemeal approach that I think will secure our borders and fix many of the issues that we have with our current system. Remember, most illegal immigration, Jordan, doesn't come through the southern border in this country. It comes through our airports, where people come here legally and then overstay their visas, and this administration has not enforced those laws. So I was surprised watching the Republican presidential... I was surprised watching the Republican presidential debate when I saw Ted Cruz offer up what his solution was not to reward anybody who was here legally with a path to citizenship, but a path to legal status so that families can continue to be united. Those are the types of debates that we have with people like Senator Cruz to come to the table and begin to this debate to fix the problems that Mark and I just talked about.
Thank you.
So that's a no, just clarifying.
On what?
In terms of the path
An
to
immediate
citizenship.
Immediate path to citizenship, amnesty? I'm not for amnesty.
Wanting to clarify.
Thanks for that, Representative Davis. And you should have actually had that question before, so I'm going to ask this, Amanda, for you to direct this question to Representative Davis to answer first.
Okay. That'll do. We're here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, that is host to a NASA Astrobiology Institute. And just this week, we had President Barack Obama publish an op-ed saying that he has a clear goal of putting a human, an American, on sending it to Mars by the 2030s. Further, you've had the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee advance legislation authorizing some $19 billion to be spent on NASA. So, if that legislation reached the U.S. House, would you vote for it? Why or why not?
Well, let's see how we're going to pay for it. I mean, this is the same president who wants to, who would want to spend trillions more and not even come close to balancing a budget. So let's see the plan, and then let's make it affordable. Let's make sure that we have that balanced budget, and let's make some of the tough decisions in Washington to reduce our mandatory spending. And how do we do that, Amanda? We've got to have Republicans and Democrats willing to sit down and realize that 66% of our budget, even if we shut the government down today, by law, Treasury has to still keep printing money to pay 66%. And as we see those programs continue to grow, it takes a cut out of the discretionary spending programs that fund visions like this. So I want to see the president sit down with congressional leaders, both the House and the Senate, and work with us to be able to not only afford something like this, but let's afford more cancer research. I think it's a tragedy that only 4% of the National Cancer Institute dollars go to pediatric cancer. I met a young boy named Johnny Wade last September. He's a twin. It really hit me because my twin boys. I walked in. He had no hair. His twin brother did because he was fighting brain cancer. And he looked at his head and he said, "We need more than 4%. I'm going to take Johnny's mission and continue to take it back to Washington, D.C., because these are the important issues that we have to face in Washington, D.C., but we have to make the tough decisions. And we've done that by passing the 21st Century Cures Act, another bill that passed in a bipartisan way in the House that is being held up in the U.S. Senate. Again, I would urge the viewers to call your U.S. senator. This is going to reform the mandatory side of our spending and allow for exponential growth in medical research. If we do nothing, Alzheimer's alone will break our current Medicare system in less than the next 20 years. It's not just that we need to go to Mars. We have to fight this challenge too.
I support research and science. What's going on over here at the University of Illinois has always amazed me with the talented young minds we have over here in Champaign, and not just here, but in Bloomington and Springfield and throughout this district. I think we have the most universities and public colleges in the state right here in the 13th. We need to move to more cooperation between universities and the government and using them for research instead of sending out money to private organizations that are raking in huge profits off of EpiPens and other medical devices and research like that, that they're raking in huge profits off taxpayer-funded sometimes and private stuff. We need to look at our universities where the brightest minds are and put them to work and get their input on some of these. And you know, how do we get to Mars? Well, we don't waste a couple billion dollars wrapping up 11-plus million immigrants and taking them back across the border. You know, with our president, we've deported more immigrants since he's been in office than the presidents before him. So the policies that are in place and that they're working through right now are doing their jobs, and we need to allow that to continue to do that instead of looking at wrapping all these people up and shipping them back to whatever country we presume they came from. And we need to keep our universities moving. We need more stronger cooperation with the universities.
Congressman Davis, I just wanted to make sure to follow up because you talked a lot about the budget, mm-hmm. and clearly budgets are always going to be an issue, and there will be for different individuals, different congresspeople with priorities in spending. So where for you does space exploration lie? It's going to take money now at some point in the soonish future in order to reach Mars by, again, the 2030s. That's not just President Barack Obama, but it was a bipartisan Senate committee that advanced that legislation. So where does space exploration fit for you? Is that a goal for you as well, to send Americans to Mars by the 2030s, by the 2040s?
Sure. Let me first...
And just a minute, please, just because we're almost out of time.
Yeah. Let me just also say I disagree with my opponent that this president has done enough to actually address those who are here legally who've overstayed their visas. Over 480,000 last year came into this country, and less than 2,000 were actually investigated and removed from this country. So when it comes to budget priorities, I will tell you, space exploration, while it is a great lofty goal in the University of Illinois, is a tremendous, tremendous asset to our communities and to our university systems throughout this country. What is here is a gem and a jewel when it comes to blue waters and other major scientific advancements that happen right here in Champaign-Urbana. Now, we have to fix our budget, and I would be glad to work with the Senate and put together an appropriations bill that will help begin the research for space exploration.
Sorry,
but we have to do Cancer Institute. We have to do cancer research too.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank our candidates this evening, Representative Davis, Mr. Wicklund. Our panelists, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for IPR, Jamie Dunn, Illinois Issues Editor for NPR Illinois, and Jordan Abadea, Political Reporter for WICS News Channel 20 in Springfield. Thanks to our studio audience and to our debate partners, NPR Illinois in Springfield, the NAACP of Champaign County, and the League of Women Voters of Champaign County. To all the voters, Election Day is November 8th. Same-day voter registration is happening in Illinois. Counties with more than 100,000 residents must allow Election Day registration. Visit elections.il.gov for more information. I'm WILL's Nyla Boodoo. Have a good evening.